Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you hear the latest on the opening of warming centers in Gary as temperatures in the region dip. Justin Hicks reports Governor Eric Holcomb announced he will appropriate $400 million of CARES Act funding to unemployment insurance. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Teach Plus Indiana Executive Director Rachel Hathaway. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Warming centers across the city of Gary are ready to open anytime the temperatures dip to 32 degrees or lower, with some new protocols in place in an effort to protect those seeking shelter from COVID-19. The Post Tribune reports Mayor Jerome Prince says the city has been working with the Calumet Township Trustee's Office, as well as several different not-for-profit organizations, to prepare safe places for anyone in need of temporary shelter. Anyone seeking to use one of the warming centers will have to take a COVID-19 test before entering. If the test comes back negative, the individual will be allowed into the warming center. If an individual tests positive, that person will not be allowed into the warming center, but instead will be given the option to leave the facility or accept a ride to a quarantine facility. Residents who need to get to a warming center can contact the Gary Police Department's non-emergency phone number at 219-660-0000.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
When he takes office on Capitol Hill next month, 1st District Congressman-elect Frank Mervan will become the co-chair of the Congressional Steel Caucus. Mervan was named to the position last week by current co-chairman Representative Connor Lamb of Pennsylvania. The Congressional Steel Caucus includes more than 100 bipartisan members of Congress. It works to promote and advance the interests of the American steel industry and steelworkers in the U.S. Congress. Mervan continues the tradition of Northwest Indiana having a seat on the Steel Caucus, just as retiring Congressman Pete Visklosky has served as its chairman during his term of office. United Steelworkers District 7 Director Mike Millsap says Mervan being named to the Steel Caucus as co-chairman is incredibly important to both steelworkers and all citizens of Northwest Indiana. U.S. Steel President and CEO David Burritt congratulated Mervan to his appointment on the Steel Caucus. He says Mervan will be leading a broad, bipartisan array of representatives as they stand up for U.S. steelmaking. Mervan received the same congratulations from Lorenzo Gonçalves, the chairman, president, and CEO of Cleveland-Cliffs, the firm that is taking over the ArcelorMittal steel mills in Northwest Indiana.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Twincade, at the corner of Broad and Main Streets in downtown Griffith, just celebrated its last weekend and plans to close sometime this week. The Retro Arcade Bar is closing its doors after the coronavirus pandemic caused business to dry up. The downtown spot was considered a destination stop for fun and games for couples and families alike, live drag shows, and so much more. The Times reports owner Patricia Seidner posted online her gratitude to the countless customers over the almost 5 years the doors were open. Due to the closing, Seidner is appealing to the community to help ease the stress of economic hardship on her employees by soliciting donations. Twincade was Northwest Indiana's first combination arcade and craft beer bar, similar to what you'd find in Chicago, Brooklyn, Indianapolis, and other cities. For more information or to donate to help the staff, find TwinCade on Facebook.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
One local program is getting pets adopted and helping keep animals safe and out of shelters. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with Humane Indiana Shelter Director Jessica Batias Hernandez about how the home-to-home program is working for cats and dogs.
Humane Indiana's home-to-home program is serving the organization well and getting animals permanent homes while keeping them out of shelters, even with the COVID-19 pandemic. Humane Indiana Shelter Director Jessica Batalis Hernandez says the program started at Humane Indiana before the pandemic took hold in the spring of 2019, and last year, 61 animals were adopted as a result of the program.
It's all kinds of reasons that people will use home-to-home, but it's really beneficial because what we have seen is animals that have spent a considerable amount of time in a home setting with a family already tend to do very poorly in a shelter. Because ultimately, no matter how good of a shelter it is, it's still kind of like an animal jail, and it's very stressful for them. It's a strange place, strange people, lots of smells, lots of sounds that they're not used to.
The home-to-home program allows for pet owners to safely rehome their pet through a database to find families waiting to adopt pets.
You know, home-to-home is a safe way for people to rehome so that they don't have to turn to places like Craigslist or Facebook where there is no oversight and there is no third party that has expertise in animal care that we can kind of work together as like a mediator between the groups.
Anyone looking for an animal to adopt or to rehome a pet can go to the Indiana Humane website, click on shelter, then click on pet admissions, and then click on learn more about the home-to-home program. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Lawmakers say they're elated Governor Eric Holcomb announced he'd appropriate $400 million of CARES Act funding to unemployment insurance. They hope to avoid federal penalties that would be incurred by Hoosier employers.
Throughout the pandemic, Indiana paid out all of the money it had, a little less than $1 billion, in a rainy day fund meant for unemployed workers. To continue paying unemployment benefits, the state began borrowing money from the federal government. If it doesn't repay that money within two consecutive years, a federal tax break for employers would be rolled back. State Representative Dan Leonard says the fund is currently about $200 million in debt. With the governor's appropriation of $400 million, he hopes that will be enough to avoid a raise in employer taxes.
I'm just elated. I think it helps employers out. So I think it was a wise use of the money.
The latest relief bill in Congress also seeks to remove interest rates on the borrowed money until March of next year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The latest court ruling on the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, allows thousands of undocumented immigrants to apply. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Paola Marazan reports some Indiana applicants are not eligible for the program.
DACA protects undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children. Approximately 640,000 immigrants have enrolled in the program nationally, around 9,000 in Indiana. Lauren Sharp helps immigrants apply for DACA. He's executive director of the International Institute, or La Casa, in Gary. He says many of the applicants he sees do not qualify for the program because of the many requirements.
You have to have entered the United States before June 15th, 2007, and physically present from June 15, 2012, or have been discharged from the Coast Guard honorably.
Other requirements include being born on or after June 15, 1981, having a diploma or GED, or be currently attending school. The fee to apply for DACA is $495. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Paola Marisan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Healthcare workers are learning that COVID-19 has the power to raise blood sugar to dangerous levels. and that's creating serious challenges for hospitals. SiteFX Public Media's Farah Yousry has more in our continuing coverage about the interplay between COVID and diabetes.
And you don't even have Fortnite, so I can't get
you. I don't have Fortnite, you're right. I am definitely not that cool.
William Rentel and his wife recovered from COVID-19 back in March. They rode it out at home with their son. Rentel is a nurse practitioner at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. He's also a type 1 diabetic. He says he's always kept his blood sugar well managed, but COVID changed that.
My insulin requirements doubled during the infection just to keep my blood sugars on a high range of normal during the time.
Having too much sugar in the blood means your body is either not producing the amount you need from a hormone called insulin or is not using it well enough. This can damage blood vessels supplying vital organs. And with a COVID infection, it seems that even non-diabetics may have a hard time with insulin too.
In the early time of COVID, 50% of those patients with a COVID diagnosis were on insulin.
That's Mary Ellen Neal, nurse and project manager at Indiana University Health Methodist Hospital. Other severe illnesses could cause elevated blood sugar levels too, but COVID is doing that at a rate that worries healthcare workers.
Of course, we need to control those blood sugars. So insulin is the treatment for that, and often it's IV insulin infusions.
To deliver that kind of care, nurses had to enter a COVID patient's room to measure blood sugar levels and adjust insulin doses as frequently as every hour, exposing the staff to the virus and using lots of protective equipment. But now Methodist Hospital is putting glucose sensors on patients.
So this technology allows the nurse to look at a device placed outside the room and see what the blood sugar is.
These sensors are typically used by diabetics at home, but the FDA has approved their use in hospitals to manage COVID patients.
Those challenges are huge.
That's Dr. Rodica Pabbusui, professor of internal medicine at the University of Michigan. She's talking about the lack of proven treatment protocols that take into account the range of problems COVID can cause. She and her colleagues have come up with an algorithm that aims to do just that.
We are not looking only at one-time glucose level, but we are also looking at the kidney involvement, at the these markers of inflammation that now we are routinely measuring. And we also measure now all these clotting markers.
This is even more crucial for patients who have diabetes. Studies show that COVID-19 can cause blood clotting that can lead to strokes. Dr. Pabbusui says diabetics are already at an increased risk of strokes. So for them, COVID poses a double threat.
It may be beyond the severe phase just in the hospital. So if you continue to have some clots that may have been not recognized, at some point one could, you know, shoot up and either cause problems in your heart or in your brain.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Back at his home in Columbus, Ohio, Rentel wonders if this is what might have happened to him. 6 months after he recovered from COVID, he had a stroke, which left him partially blind.
Which we hope will recover, but we won't know for a year. My wife has basically stepped in and helped me with all of my daily activities.
I just loaded it with 3 mL of insulin into the cartridge itself, and now we'll load a new cartridge. So go ahead and click the button to change cartridge.
Rentel asked his doctors whether his diabetes or COVID triggered the stroke.
They felt that our COVID infection was the most probable cause of the stroke, but we still couldn't get a definitive answer.
Further studies may offer conclusive answers. Until then, clinicians agree that as long as the pandemic persists, diabetics need to keep tight control of their blood sugar levels because a COVID infection could be devastating. For SiteFX Public Media, I'm Farah Yousry.
This reporting is supported by the GBH Educational Foundation through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Teach Plus Indiana Executive Director Rachel Hathaway.
Indiana school districts and the schools themselves are trying, of course, to navigate the demands of virtual and hybrid and in-person learning and teaching as they respond to the pandemic these days in real time. And organizations like an organization called Teach Plus, which normally works with teachers, experienced teachers, to help them learn how to take over leadership roles in some key policy and practice issues that in turn will affect student success in the classroom. The organization has put out a recent report, which is entitled Improving as We Go, Learning from Indiana District Reentry Plans. And of course, this is all dealing with schools going back into session during the pandemic. With us to talk about the report and about the organization is Rachel Hathaway. She is the Teach Plus Indiana Executive Director. And Rachel, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, just take a moment to explain more for people that are not familiar with Teach Plus and in particular how they've gotten involved in creating this report that's out there now.
Yeah, I'd love to. So we're a nonprofit that's focused on really empowering teacher voice in the classroom as well as at the policy level. We believe that educators are the folks who have the best understanding of what a classroom looks like, how policies and laws are impacting their daily lives. And so we really want to raise up their experiences so that they have a voice in decision-making processes when it comes to policies, when it comes to instruction. And so we run a fellowship that allows for educators to be trained on kind of that intro to policy, where they're thinking about their impact not only in the four walls of their classroom, which is where we want to keep them, but also what is their opportunity to grow and have an impact outside of those four walls. And so that's kind of our focus. And the way that we got into our report was that because we work directly with teachers and really work to try to elevate their voices and their experience, we've seen that as people were reapproaching to the return to schools, it was often coming from district level, right? So it was administrators doing what they could to set up a plan that then teachers were then responding to, as opposed to not always necessarily being a part of those conversations. And so looking at the district plans, we were also seeing a lot of variation because with guidance from the state, there was, you know, high level, this is what you could do, but we're really going to defer to you all at the local level. And so our hope was that by kind of digging into some of these district reentry plans, we could better understand what are some of the best practices, how are teachers feeling, do they feel well supported, and then elevate their experience and their voices in the process.
When during the pandemic, did you folks have an opportunity to actually start gathering data together and in turn start you're consulting with teachers and the like and get the information together that is now part of the report?
So we've actually been in contact with our teachers since, you know, March and before that. And so there had been conversations where we were all just trying to figure out what's happening, where are we going from here. In June, we really started to do some virtual sessions where we brought our teachers together and had a little bit more structured conversation about, you know, some questions that they could reflect on, kind of be thoughtful of what it looked like for their concerns coming into that following school year. And so we conducted focus groups where we had about 50 Indiana teachers share their insights, share their thoughts. And then with that in mind, then embarked upon doing some more in-depth analysis with the actual reentry plans as they started to come out and were available later in the summer and into the fall. So with a combination of both the focus groups and then as these the analysis of the reentry plans, we were able to come forward with the findings and then really be thoughtful about how do we adjust this, right? How do we fill that gap and ensure that teacher voice is a part of these conversations? And how do we, knowing that everyone is kind of trying to do their best right now, right? Everyone is. District leaders, school leaders, teachers, we're all kind of flying by the seat of our pants. Mm-hmm. But how do we continue to improve that going from now with us 6 months into the school year? How do we continue to move forward to the end of the school year and really be thoughtful of improving based on what our teachers are actually experiencing? Since they're the ones who are on the front lines working directly with students and with their families, what are they learning? What's not going well? What's working well? Because we're also seeing positive things come from this moment in time, right? We're seeing innovations. We're seeing teachers step up and have opportunity to be creative and to find innovative solutions to meet the needs of their families. And we are seeing districts step up in ways as well. But it's how do we continue to raise up those best practices so that across the state we're having improved experience for not only our students, but for our teachers across districts.
We're talking with Rachel Hathaway. She is the Indiana Executive Director of the organization called Teach Plus. They put out a report which is entitled Improving as We Go, Learning from Indiana District Reentry Plans. And, of course, it's involving getting school districts back in session as the pandemic continues. If you will, Rachel, go into some detail here about some of the recommendations that you folks have made in the report.
Yeah. So the recommendations, we tried to be thoughtful, again, about having grace for where we're all in this together and we're all learning.
Right.
But, again, how do we continue to learn and improve as we're going forward? So our thoughts were around our teachers. They are stepping up in a big way to meet this moment. Some of them are working, you know, 10-hour days. I've talked to some of our teachers where they said, you know, I had to skip lunch and I only was able to eat a cheese stick at 10 a.m. in the morning, right? And finding that they've stepped up in ways that are not just about instruction, but about meeting the needs of their students, whether it's social and emotional, where they're, you know, worried about their students' mental health and the gaps that are created by this pandemic, whether it's technical support, and some of our teachers are, you know, learning on the fly how to be tech experts while also then facilitating their education. And the response has been excellent from partners in sense of, like, the Department of Education has put out a lot of different great resources. Lots of nonprofits have provided professional development resources. The challenge becomes that when we don't have the time for the teachers to take advantage of those professional development resources to then actually implement them, it creates overcapacity for our teachers. Mm-hmm. So even if they want to take and be developed, they don't have the time to actually implement, and it can create overwhelm. And so what we've put forward in some of our recommendations were, you know, let's build in some more flexibility for that time. Let's be more thoughtful about thinking about instructional hours as opposed to instructional days, so that schools can be flexible in providing more professional development days or more unique scheduling so that it meets the needs of the students and the teachers. In addition to that, coming back to that mental health, we've seen not only for students, but for teachers, we're seeing that mental health is all the more important in this moment of oddity. And so how do districts better support their mental health with their teachers? It's by providing access to resources. Back in earlier this year, I guess, 2020, we passed a piece of legislation that allowed for, or now required, that school districts create MOUs to allow for support for student mental health. And our recommendation in that on the report is, how can we then expand those MOUs to then include teacher mental support as well, mental health support.
Now, you mentioned the General Assembly and this measure that got passed here. Are there any of the ideas and recommendations that are in the report that is out there now that you may ask lawmakers to take a look at when they come back into session here in January?
It's an interesting question. So there's been a lot of districts that we've seen take advantage of the recently passed HB 1003, I believe, that looks at the flexibility waivers for scheduling. And so you've seen districts actually acting on these recommendations already. We've just kind of put them forward and we're saying, yeah, this is the action. So it's kind of an affirming moment, right, when districts have already started to do this, and it aligns with the recommendations we've put out. So I think that there will be a question of how do we continue to create that flexibility, whether it's via legislation or if it's a continued use of these flexibility waivers. So that's one that I'd say would be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm.
And then to what I just spoke to, the student mental health,
right,
or teacher mental health supports. Those, I'm not quite sure what else is going to be covered over in session. I know funding is going to be a big, big, big question, right, as we're continuing to navigate the impacts of the coronavirus, as well as setting the two-year budget. Our hope is to continue to see, you know, education funding supported. The commission for the governor's teacher pay report just came out yesterday, as I'm sure you saw, and it's got some extensive recommendations that we're still trying to process of that. I think there's some really positive things we've seen and some others that we have a few more questions. So I think it's just going to be a really intriguing session coming up, and our hope is that we can ensure that teacher voice is incorporated into that process.
That's probably the nicest way that anybody's been able to put how the General Assembly seems to work, that it's going to be a nice, interesting session, to say the least. Now, let me ask, if anybody's interested in looking at the details in this report that is out there, how can they find out the information?
Yeah, they can find it on our website, which is teachplus.org, and go to our publications page, and you'll see it right at the top.
Rachel Hathaway is the Teach Plus Indiana Executive Director, and the organization has put out a new report, which is entitled Improving as We Go, Learning from Indiana District Reentry Plans, as we're dealing with getting education back underway in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. And Rachel, thank you very much for being with us to go over the report and explain, and we'll all watch the General Assembly very closely in this early year coming up and see if they do actually take care of some new of the issues that are taken up in the report. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.